grace in these difficult times after being married over 50 years. We also are grateful for the opportunity to be back here again. I think it was 4 years ago when we spoke on Islam here. Some of you may remember. And to see all of our friends from the counter-cult and discernment ministries that are here tonight. It's always a great privilege to be with everyone. As I thought of the topic that was assigned to me, defending the faith in a postmodern world, I was reminded of the question I once asked my class, what is the greatest problem in the world today? Is it ignorance or is it apathy? One of my students said, I don't know and I don't care. That probably is the greatest problem in the world right there when it comes to what's going on and how Christianity should relate. But tucked away in the Old Testament, in the book of Chronicles, not one you probably had your devotions in recently, particularly the first nine chapters, in chapter 12 and verse 32, there's a verse that I would like to take off from tonight. It says, of the children of Issachar, who had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do. My thesis tonight is relatively simple. We can't be satisfied with just knowing the truth. We also need to understand the times. It's insufficient for us to say, well, I know the Word of God, if we don't know the world to which we're communicating that word. It's not enough to say, well, I've got the message of the gospel, if we don't comprehend the milieu into which we preach that message. A number of years ago, I was associated with a group called Youth for Christ, and the motto was, anchored to the rock, but geared to the times. And I think that's still a good motto today. I know many people are anchored to the rock, and they're not moving. The times are passing them by. I know others who are geared to the times and their ship is floating freely without an anchor. And what we want to stress this evening is how to understand our postmodern times and how to defend the gospel of Christ in those times. And so I've divided my comments into three basic categories. What is postmodernism? Two, what are the chief characteristics of postmodernism so that we can understand it? And then three, what is the best way to defend the gospel in a postmodern world? Postmodernism has been described both in a temporal way and in a philosophical way. The temporal way, of course, it's the movement that comes after modernism. But that doesn't help us unless we know what and when modernism dominated our culture. Some people say, as Toynbee, that modernism took us up through Nazism, through the Second World War, and that postmodernism began after the Second World War, 1947 and following. Others like Odin say that it's really after Marxism that modernism took us up to the death of Marxism in 1989. And that's really the story from the Bastille Wall to the Berlin Wall for modernism and from the Berlin Wall to the present for postmodernism. Be that as it may be, I think we can helpfully describe the difference between modernism and postmodernism in what is really a kind of two-column chart here. And I want to say on the one hand what modernism believed, and then to understand our culture today by way of contrast, what this postmodern world is saying whenever you date it. First of all, modernism stressed unity in the culture. Postmodernism stresses diversity. Unity is out and diversity is in. Philosophically, in the modern world, there was a stress on rationalism, the use of the mind. In the postmodern world, there's a stress on mysticism, the use of the heart. In modernism, the dominant worldview was naturalistic. No miracles emanating from Benedict Spinoza in 1670, and later, 100 years later, David Hume's work on the inquiry concerning human understanding. In the postmodern world, the emphasis is more nihilistic, the negation of values. As to government in the modern world, the stress was on the democratic. Today, the stress is on the anarchic, the rebellion against the institutions that exist. As for human beings, they were conceived of as rational beings in the modern world. Today, they're thought of as social beings. In the realm of knowing, the stress in modernism was on how we know, a discipline called epistemology, from episteme, the Greek word for knowledge. In the modern world, the shift has been from epistemology to hermeneutics, how we interpret, and we've gone from the realm of education, from thinking to feeling, from the cognitive to the affective, from the left side of the brain to the right side of the brain in this postmodern world. In how we teach pedagogy, in modernism, the stress was on the conceptual. Today, the stress is on the visual. As to the dominant discipline in the modern world was science. Today, the dominant discipline is art. In the realm of religious views, the modern world was dominated by agnosticism and atheism. Today is dominated by pantheism and polytheism. In the realm of truth, we went from the absolute to the relative, from a quest for absolute truth like Spinoza and those who would write after their geometric proofs, QED, which was to be proven and is now proven, and Descartes, who tried to find the absolutely certain conclusion, to people who are content with relativism and content with moving from the objective realm of truth to the subjective. The characteristic of the modern world was exclusivism. One discovers truth and everything else is excluded as false. Today, the stress is on pluralism. Everything is true. In the realm of science in the modern world, the stress was on determinism. Newton had determined a law that applied to all of the world, the law of gravitation. In the modern world, the postmodern world, the stress is on indeterminacy, as Heisenberg and the subatomic realm took over and decided that there was random motion of atoms. In the realm of certainty, the modern world was in the quest for certainty. Today, in the postmodern world, we're content with uncertainty. Ethics was collectivistic, whether it was a Marxist collectivism or a humanistic collectivism or a rational one, didn't matter. In the postmodern world, the stress is not collectivistic but individualistic. As for literature, in the modern world, there was a quest to find the structure, the order of a piece of literature. Today, the shift has gone from structuralism to deconstructionism. And so with those kind of shifts, we can see that our society has moved from unity to diversity, from rationalism to mysticism, from naturalism to nihilism, from atheism to pantheism. And we stand as the Apostle Paul stood on Mars Hill, and he ministered to the Epicureans and the Stoics. The Epicureans were the atheists. The Stoics were the pantheists. The Epicureans said there is no God at all. The Stoics said God is all. And there the Apostle Paul stood with a third message: God created all. And we still stand on that same Mars Hill today as Christians trying to minister to the atheist who says there is no God at all, and the pantheist who says God is all, proclaiming that God created all. And what I want to do for you in my second point here is to list seven of the chief characteristics of the postmodern world so that you can understand it. And these characteristics unfold relatively sequentially as I take them. The first one is, in my opinion, one that flows from the root of postmodernism, and that's a man who died in 1900. Now, while the tree didn't blossom until after the Second World War or the fall of communism, the root was firmly planted in a guy named Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche wrote a number of books, and his most famous statement is, God is dead, signed Nietzsche, under which some unknown hand wrote, Nietzsche is dead, signed God. But I think the first characteristic of postmodernism is atheism. Atheism took several varieties in the modern world. The atheism of Nietzsche was a form of nihilism. The atheism of Jean-Paul Sartre was a form of existentialism. Just let me touch briefly on this death of God. Now, of course, God wasn't alive and then actually died, but Nietzsche was saying, what I believe is that the myth of God once lived. The people thought that was a viable model by which they can live, and now that model is no longer viable, and so he pronounced the death of God. There was a very short-lived movement called the Death of God Movement back in the 70s, headed up by Thomas Altizer. Thomas Altizer said God died three ways in the world. First of all, God died in the incarnation. When God became man, he ceased being God. When Christ left heaven, heaven was empty. And so in becoming a man, God died. Secondly, Altizer said God died on a cross. When Jesus was crucified, he died. Since he didn't believe in the resurrection, God died both in the incarnation and the crucifixion. Then third, and this is what's happening in postmodernism, God started to die in the culture. In the year 1900, Nietzsche died, the one who said God is dead. And so this century has been really the century of atheism because the death of God finally worked its way out into the culture, from the incarnation to the crucifixion to the culture. And there are many things very prophetic about what Nietzsche said, because indeed that's pretty well what did happen. Somebody said we live not only in a postmodern world, but it's a post-Christian world, where you can hear the recessional of Christianity playing in the backyard and the background as the churches bury God, as the ministers are the pallbearers of God, and as they're singing the recessional of Christianity in the background. One of the most popular atheists of the 60s and even into the 70s was a man named Jean-Paul Sartre, French existential atheist, who wrote several books. One was entitled Nausea. Bleh, that's what he thought of life. Another was titled No Exit. That was a play. And his magnum opus had the title of Being and Nothingness. In this book, he said, all of life is an empty bubble on the sea of nothingness. There's not much there. An empty bubble on the sea of nothingness. That reminds me of what Harry Truman once said of a political opponent. He said, that guy's nothing but a rimless zero. Now, there's not too much to a rimless zero. It's kind of like a skin, a balloon without the skin on it. That's what Sartre thought of life. It's totally meaningless. In fact, life was so meaningless that he was offered the Nobel Prize for Literature for the books that he had written. And he turned it down saying, there's no meaning in any of my books. If I accept this prize, I'll be assuming there's some meaning in my writing. There's no meaning at all. in anything that I say. One can only wonder why someone would read it, but at the same time, that's what he believed. In the wake of the death of God came the second characteristic of the postmodern world, the death of man. The death of man. Now, if the death of God is atheism, the death of man is really anti-humanitarianism. And the strange thing that happened was a logical outworking of the death of God. Because if God is dead, then man must die also. Dostoevsky pointed to that in The Brothers Karamazov when he said, if God is dead, anything goes. Because if there is no moral law giver, then there is no moral law to tell us what we must do with man. And the evolutionism of Darwin, which was so crucial in perpetrating atheism, though Darwin himself was an agnostic, the evolutionism of Darwin led Karl Marx to say, nowadays, in our evolutionary theory of the universe, there's absolutely no room for God or a ruler. God must be buried. As early as 1878, just 7 years after Darwin told the world that man had evolved, in his book, The Descent of Man, in Origin of the Species, 1859, he said animals had evolved, but he didn't talk about man's evolution. In 1878, 7 years after Darwin told the world that man had evolved by purely natural processes, there was no need for a creator. In fact, he said in that very book, there is no evidence that man was created by some omnipotent creator. Darwin gave rise to a view called the survival of the fittest. And as early as 1928, Hitler had taken that theory and had applied it to society. As indeed Haeckel, the famous Darwinist and contemporary of Darwin, had already done and taught in the schools of Germany for two generations. And when Hitler came on the scene, they were already totally indoctrinated in atheism, evolutionism, and naturalism, and Hitler was just working out the logic of that. And here's what Hitler said in Mein Kampf, which he wrote in 1924. He said, evolution has taught us the survival of the superior races. In fact, the subtitle of Darwin's book on the origin of species is a racist subtitle because it speaks about the favored races of mankind. And many people overlook that subtitle. But this was taught in the schools. In fact, the textbook that was used at the Scopes trial the very next year in 1925, the very next year after Hitler wrote Mein Kampf, Mein Struggle, the textbook there that John Scopes taught from was a racist textbook saying that we evolved and the white race is the superior race. Right in the textbook. Of course, the creationists who wanted to teach that all men were created equal were looked at as bigots, while the evolutionists who believed that the white race was the superior race and were teaching that in the schools came out as the heroes. That's because they were supported by liberal media that presented it. But what I'm getting at is this simple point. Hitler in Mein Kampf said, if evolution has weeded out the inferior races of mankind, the inferior breeds, then it is our obligation to do the same thing. And with that godless teaching, Hitler killed 12 million people, 6 million Jews and 6 million non-Jews. Stalin, who took that teaching from Marx, killed at least 18 million and maybe more. The Chinese, who took the same doctrine, killed at least 30 million, some say 60 million, of their own people. Of course, in the United States, we said it will never happen here. The truth of the matter is that we have already killed more than 35 million since 1973, when that doctrine became the official dogma of our public schools in America. It happens to be called abortion. So what happens when God dies is man dies. In fact, the best summary of the last 200 years that I know of in two sentences is God died in the 19th century and man died in the 20th century. In the 19th century, man killed God by way of the theory of evolution, naturalistic, godless theory. In the 20th century, man killed man. Because, you see, when you kill God in whose image man is made, then you have to kill man made in the image of God. When you have denied the reality of God, you have undermined the dignity of man. And so there is a logical connection, and the first two premises of the postmodern world are the death of God and the death of man. Anti-humanitarianism in Marxism, Nazism, humanism, which promoted abortion and even forms of genocide and racism and euthanasia. One of the interesting things that happens when man dies is that both nature and animals rise. And so what we have in the wake of the death of man is environmentalism. What is environmentalism? It says nature over people. Now, I'm not talking about the legitimate concern for the environment that every Christian ought to have because this is my Father's world and we're custodians of it. I'm talking about the movement, the anti-Christian movement of environmentalism, which has replaced people with nature and replaced human rights with animal rights. Never seemed to dawn on them that you can't have moral rights unless you're a moral being. There's no such thing as animal rights. There are wrongs that people do to animals. The Bible says if you are a believer, your dog should live a better life in Proverbs. But there's no such thing as a moral right for an animal because an animal isn't a moral creature. And only moral creatures can have moral rights. In fact, one of the little plaques that I like the most is a plaque of a baby seal walking up and down in front of an abortion clinic saying, "Save the babies." You know, the irony of our culture is that while we spend millions of dollars to get a couple whales out of the ice in Alaska several years ago, we kill 4,300 babies every day, one every 20 seconds, three babies every minute. There's something wrong with a culture that places animal rights higher than human rights, that has more compassion for baby seals than it does for baby humans. That's all in the wake of the death of man. That moves me quickly to my third point, the death of values. You see, when God dies, man dies, both logically and historically. And when God dies, values die, for the simple reason that if there is no absolute moral lawgiver, there can't be any absolute moral laws. That if there is no absolute legislator, there can't be any absolute legislation. It follows logically and historically that when God dies, relativism is going to take over. Because when you no longer have an absolute God, an absolute source, you're not going to have any absolute values either. And so we have books like Alan Bloom's book, written by a secularist, a Jewish classicist who translated Plato and Rousseau and taught at the University of Chicago and wrote busting book on the closing of the American mind, in which he says, what's wrong with American higher education is that we've given up absolute truth, absolute values, and we've given up the Bible as a revelation from God. He was simply describing what was happening in our postmodern world. And he would put it this way. When students come in at the University of Chicago, the one thing you can be absolutely sure of is they're all relativist. And, of course, that is the very problem with the death of values. Now, the death of values in our culture has taken many, many forms. Let me just mention a few of them. One of the forms it takes is individualism. That's the idol of the self. Another one is reductionism. That's the idol of sensation. A third is hedonism, the idol of sensuality. Another is multiculturalism, the idol of plurality. And then the last one is ethnicism, the idol of ethnicity. All of these things, individualism, reductionism, hedonism, multiculturalism, and ethnicism, have replaced the absolutism that once existed when people believed in an absolute moral lawgiver. I was coming back from Europe, I believe it was 1978. And on the airplane, they gave us Time magazine and the European cover. It wasn't on the American cover because they vary around the globe. The European cover was something that etched itself in my memory forever thereafter. It said, God is dead, Marx is dead, and I'm not feeling too well either. Which was a beautiful description as early as 1978 of what had happened in our culture. God died, Marx died, and I wasn't feeling too well either. There was nothing left. The hope of the world that seemed to be in communism was fading too, and it didn't take many more years before it too collapsed. So the death of God, the death of man, and the death of values is followed only by, number four, the death of meaning. We live in a society in which there is no more meaning, at least no more objective meaning. There is no more meaning for history. There's no meaning for life. There's no meaning for the universe. Each person may have his own meaning, as Sartre said. You can create your own meaning. I am my books, he said. But even then, when asked, there's no meaning in his writing. There's no ultimate significance there at all. Everyone is doing his own little thing. Subjectivism and relativism. Subjectivism says there's only meaning to me. There's no meaning in itself. There is subjective meaning, but no objective meaning. Relativism says that it's all relative to me. In fact, to show you how far this has gone, this idea of the death of meaning and the term that describes it in philosophy is conventionalism, the view that all meaning is culturally relative. It's gone so far that I was teaching at a Christian university, a very conservative Christian university a number of years ago. I was giving a series of lectures to the faculty on trying to integrate Christianity with their discipline. I said something like, every discipline has a Christian point of view. There's a Christian point of view in math, in history, in science. There's a Christian point of view in language, in literature. And the only reason for our existence as a Christian school is we teach a Christian worldview. And after I was finished and open for questions, one professor challenged me. He said, well, I teach in a linguistic department, and there is no Christian view of linguistics. Linguistics is linguistics. You know, like somebody would say, math is math. 2 + 2 = 4. It doesn't matter whether you're Christian or an atheist. And he said, there's no Christian view in linguistics. And so I bit my tongue before I answered, because what I felt like saying was this. I can't believe you're teaching a Christian school, signing the doctrinal statement that says the Bible is the infallible, inerrant, absolute truth of God, and you don't believe that there is anything in your discipline that could be contrary to that. So instead of saying that to him, I said, what is the dominant theory of meaning in linguistics today? And he correctly said, conventionalism, which of course springs from Saussure and Wittgenstein and some of the names like that. And I said, what does conventionalism teach? It teaches that all meaning is relative to the culture or subculture in which it's found. There is no absolute meaning. Is that correct? He said, well, yes, that's what conventionalism teaches. I said, if all meaning is relative and all true statements are meaningful, then all truth is relative. Then how can you sign a statement saying the Bible is the absolute truth of God and teach a theory of meaning that says there are no absolutes? He had no idea that he was undermining with his left hand what he was affirming with his right hand. There was an old Southern preacher named Vance Havner. I don't know if you ever heard him speak or any tapes, but one of his favorite lines about relativists and liberals was, I'm looking for one-arm preachers, because every liberal preacher I ever met always says, on the one hand this, and the other hand that. And he takes away the left hand what he gave it the right hand. So he was looking for, he said, God is looking for one-arm preachers. The death of God leads to the death of man. The death of God leads to the death of values. And the death of God leads to the death of meaning. You know why? Because if there is no ultimate meaner, there is no ultimate meaning. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure this stuff out. If there is no moral lawgiver, there is no moral law. If there is no creator, there is no creation. You have to teach evolution. There's nothing else to teach. And if there is no meaner, there is no meaning. Nietzsche was so sharp and so smart, and he's one of the most brilliant atheists who ever lived. Nietzsche was one of the most honest atheists who ever lived. These are three exact quotes from Nietzsche. God is dead, Christ is an idiot, and Christians are nincompoops. He told it like he saw it. Nietzsche was not a covert believer. He was not a closet fundamentalist. Nietzsche was a real live atheist. And Nietzsche said, we won't be able to finally pronounce God dead until we pronounce grammar dead. And I'm not talking about the one that married Grandpa. I'm talking about grammar. What is grammar? Grammar is structure. Grammar implies meaning. And as long as you admit grammar and meaning, somebody sooner or later is going to say, there must be some ultimate meaning or meaner in the universe. So we got to get rid of grammar if we're going to get rid of God. And guess what's happening in the deconstructionism, the postmodernism of our day? They're getting rid of all meaning and all truth that was contained in it. That leads to the next one, which is the death of truth. We live in a postmodern world in which truth is dead. Your truth is your truth. My truth is my truth. All truth is relative. And there are two characteristics of the death of truth I want to stress. Relativism and pluralism. Relativism says all truth is relative. That may be true for you, but it's not true for me. That may be true for the Buddhist, but it's not true for a Hindu, and so forth. All truth is relative. To show you how far that got into Christian schools, one of the top Christian philosophers in America who taught at one of the top Christian schools in America, where I studied for a number of years, and if you want to find out, you just look at my resume, said, quote, all truth is perspectival. And he taught over and over in all the years that all the students he had that all truth is relative. And I said to him one day, if all truth is perspectival, how about that statement that all truth is perspectival? Is that a perspectival statement or is that a non-perspectival statement? He had never thought of it. You know, it's not nice for students to do that to professors, so he wasn't too happy with me. But if you teach that everything is just a matter of your perspective, and there is no absolute perspective. You see, if there's a God, there's an absolute perspective on everything. And if God has revealed himself in his word, you've got the absolute perspective on it. Of course, if God is dead, there is no absolute perspective, then every little pipsqueak can stand up on his little podium and proclaim his truth. But that's exactly the problem. All truth becomes relative then. Not only is relativism taken over, it says truth is made, not found. Truth is created, not discovered. But pluralism. Pluralism says all views are true. There are no views false. Anyone who holds exclusivism, which is, of course, what we believe as Christians, that there is the truth and everything opposed to it is false, is a narrow-minded. They're even calling it terms worse than that today. They're calling it by terms that are used only in the political realm, you know, like a monarchical view of truth or or a totalitarian view of truth. What we need is a more democratic view of truth where everybody can be right. Pluralism is the characteristic of a postmodern world. Now we not only have the death of God and the death of man and the death of values and the death of meaning and the death of truth, but we have the death of the book. Would you believe that the book is dead now? You say, what book? Books in general. I'm talking about the book generically. Libraries are dying, and what's replacing libraries? Of course, CDs and the internet and television. The book has died, and in this postmodern world where the book is if not dead, it's taking some very deep breaths, it's been replaced by three things: visualism, internetism, and deconstructionism. Visualism. I've been teaching for 40 years, not quite as long as Dr. Lewis, and I noticed in the last 5 to 6 years particularly that my students cannot understand concepts anymore. They don't have a conceptual understanding. And I guess I keep forgetting how old I am. I'm so old that I grew up without television. Back when people read books, you know, before there was television. Television didn't come in until I was a senior in high school. And you know what? I can still think. I can still think conceptually. Television destroys your ability to think conceptually if you had any to begin with. You have to draw a picture. I'm trying to explain some theological or philosophical argument in class, and they're sitting there like bumps on a log until I draw a picture. As soon as I draw a picture or do an overhead or get out a PowerPoint or something, then suddenly their eyes open up. They can't understand it if you don't draw a picture. That's the postmodern world, visualism. Just think of the hours. The average person in the United States watches television 4 hours a day, and he reads 18 minutes. 18 minutes a day. And, of course, who knows now what the statistics are for the computer. Take television and the computer, practically replaced the book. The book is dead, and visualism is alive. Internetism. I think probably one of the most devastating things that ever happened to our culture is the World Wide Web. There is no morals. There are no checks. Some soapbox idiot is on the same level as a PhD, and you don't know who is who sometimes. You know, enter a chat room. It could be a group of nincompoops talking, or it might be some brilliant professors. Internetism has taken over, and what we have today is the book is dying, the net is alive, television is alive. Those two are merging now before our very eyes. And with the death of the book, of course, is the death of the author, and that's a movement called deconstructionism. Doesn't matter what the author meant by the book. Once he wrote it, he died. And now the reader is alive, and the reader can read the book and read his meaning into the book and reconstruct it. Can deconstruct the author and reconstruct his own meaning. A book becomes putty and plastic in the hand of the reader, and there is no objective meaning from the author in the book. I think the best way I've ever heard this deconstruction described is by the three umpires in the world before the modern world, the modern world, and the postmodern world. In the pre-modern world, the umpire said, "I call it like it is." In the modern world, the umpire said, "I call it like I see it." In the postmodern world, the umpire says, "It ain't nothing till I call it." That's precisely what is happening in the realm of meaning and interpretation today. We're experiencing the death of the book. Now, guess what? If God is dead, truth is dead, values is dead, and the book is dead, Christianity is dead. Because there is no Christianity without a book that has meaning, that you can derive that meaning from, that is objective and absolute, and that comes from an absolute God out there who has given an absolute moral law by which we live. All of these, I've never seen at any time in my lifetime, nor in most times in the history of the world, I've never seen such an all-out attack in every angle of Christianity, and you can't, and they're all intertwined in such a unique way that if my postmodernism is correct, Christianity is absolutely dead. That leads to my last contrast or characteristic, and that is the death of history. Christianity is a historical religion. God acted in history. He acted in history in the Exodus. He acted in history in the Incarnation. He acted in history in the cross and the resurrection. He'll act in history of the second coming. So historical religion. And without history and without the historicity of those events, Christianity isn't true. So history is very important to us. And the death of history today says we can't really know, nor if we could, are we concerned to know what really happened. We want to revise it and make it what we would like it to mean to us. Revisionism. The past is destroyed in the favor of the present. History is made, not reported. History is created in our own image. I've never seen a better example of it than when I was on the University of Virginia campus a number of years ago. A friend of mine, Dr. Nix, who has a PhD in history and a minor in archaeology, were looking at a statue in the end in the quad there at the University of Virginia, started by Thomas Jefferson. And it caught our attention because the plaque was taken off it. So we didn't know who the author was, so we had to guess at who it was, and looked to us like it was Saul and David. Looked to us like it was Saul and David because, first of all, it looked like the man sitting there had a Jewish skull cap on, and the little boy had a Jewish harp, and there were other things. And so we went into the archivist and asked, who did this and what is it? She said, that's Homer and Friend. And we said, ma'am, couldn't be Homer because Homer wasn't Jewish. He wouldn't have been wearing a Jewish skull cap. She said, it's Homer and Friend. I said, well, ma'am, the little boy there is playing a Jewish harp, and he has a little Jewish ram horn next to him, and he's got a Jewish sheepskin over his arm. He was a shepherd. It's got to be David, not Homer's Friend. And she got angry, and she said, opened the book and looked right in there, and there it said, Homer and Friend in the archivist book. And so we said, ma'am, that cannot be Homer because Homer was blind and this man can see in the statue. And Nunchia really got angry at us. And she's about ready to throw us out and said, this is Homer and Friend, which my friend Dr. Nick said to her, ma'am, Homer was a Gentile and Saul was a Jew. The man on this statue is circumcised. It couldn't have been Homer. And she said to him, how do you know? He said, I peeked. Later we found that the name of the sculptor was Jeremiah Ezekiel. Now if you believe that Jeremiah Ezekiel put a skull cap on Homer, gave his little friend a Jewish ram's horn and a sheepskin and circumcised Homer, I can sell you a bridge that's been sold to many people many times before. That leads me to my last point, how to do apologetics in a postmodern world. Four suggestions from Dr. Millard Erickson, and he uses the horse and the water illustration here. How do we lead the deconstructed horse to the water in this postmodern world? He said there are four ways to go about it. Can we lead a deconstructed horse to the water? He said, yes, but deconstructed water to attract the horse. Not the translation of truth, but the transformation of truth. Well, number two, yes, but we must use a deconstructed halter and rope to lead the horse. It's another method we could use. Three, yes, but the horse is not really deconstructed. Give the same water to the same horse. Or four, yes, but reconstruct the horse. Push the horse to understand that he cannot live as a deconstructive horse. In other words, take a new look at Dr. Francis Schaeffer. Now, I think that Dr. Erickson left out one, and I'd like to suggest a fifth way, and that is don't deconstruct the halter, deconstruct the horse. Show him that he is a self-defeating horse. In other words, show him that he isn't making horse sense. Show the horse, this modern, postmodern deconstruction world, show them that they're not making horse sense. Show them that horse sense is stable thinking. That is, in the main. And I want to do that in a couple areas here to show you how it works. Someone has said that Dr. Francis Schaeffer's method of apologetics was basically this. That you show the unbeliever that he cannot live his beliefs. That you take his presupposition and you show that he can't possibly live. That his presuppositions, and in this case the postmodern presuppositions, are unlivable. Well, I'd like to take it one step further. Not that I think that isn't a possible way of doing it, but I'd like to show you that deconstruction presuppositions are unthinkable. In fact, they're unaffirmable. And I'll give you a couple of illustrations of this. Let me start, first of all, with atheism. God is dead. One night, our church was using the evangelism explosion technique, and so a friend of mine and I were out knocking on doors, and we knocked on a door, and a man answered the door, and we said to him, would you mind if we ask you a very serious spiritual question? It's a good way to get into a conversation. He said, no, go ahead. So I said to him, if you were to die and stand before God and God would say to you, why should I let you into my heaven, what would he say? That's what James Kennedy taught in his method. And his answer was a little startling. He said, I would say to God, why shouldn't you let me in? It's not in the book. You're not supposed to say that. There are two answers, and that's not one of them. One answer is, you know, I did good works and I deserve to be here. And the other one is, I've got a blood-stained ticket that Jesus gave me from dying on a cross for me. But that one's not in the book, so I didn't know what to do. So I ushered up a quick prayer, like help. Exodus 4:12. Now therefore go, and I will be with thy mouth and teach thee that thou shalt say. So here's what God gave me to say to him. I said, look, if we knocked on your door and you didn't want to let us in your house, and I said to you, why shouldn't you let me into your house? What would you say to me? He said, I'd tell you where to go. I said, that's exactly what God's going to tell you. Now that kind of got him serious, sobered him up for a moment. And then he said, really, I'm an atheist, so I don't even believe in God. All right, how do you lead the deconstructed horse to the water? He's an atheist. You're trying to get him to believe in the Son of God and the Word of God, and he doesn't even believe in God, right? So I said, are you absolutely sure there's no God? He thought, and he said, well, no, I'm not absolutely sure. You can't be absolutely sure. I said, well, there might be one then, right? I said, you know the difference between an atheist? An atheist says, I know that there's a God. And an agnostic says, I don't know if there's a God. I said, if you're not absolutely sure, then you don't know that there's no God. You just don't know if there's a God. He said, well, I guess maybe I'm just an agnostic. So we moved from atheism to agnosticism in just a few minutes. I said, tell me, which kind are you, the ornery kind or the ordinary kind? There are two kinds of agnostics. One says, I can't know, and the other says, I don't know. Sure enough, he was the ornery kind, who says you can't know. So I said, let me ask you this. Do you know for sure that you can't know anything for sure? said, what do you mean? I said, well, if you know for sure that you can't know anything for sure, then you know something for sure, then you're not the ornery kind of agnostic. You're just a common garden variety. I don't know. So I guess I just am the common garden variety then. I don't know if there's a God. I said, why don't you know? He said, because it's impossible. He said, wait a minute. If you don't know because it's impossible, then you can't know. If you know you can't know, we're right back where we started here, aren't we? He said, well, I don't know because I've never seen any evidence. Ah, nice person to talk to, an open-minded agnostic. I'd rather talk to an open-minded agnostic than a closed-minded Jehovah's Witness or Mormon any day. I gave him a book by a skeptic who set out to disprove Christianity and was converted, named Frank Morrison, Who Moved the Stone. Came back, talked to him, said, what do you think? He said, very convincing. We led him to Christ. He's a Baptist deacon in Festus, Missouri, in a little Baptist church. He's already reared all of his children for the Lord. They're all believers. He drives a little Sunday school bus picking up other kids. Guess what? About 40 years before that, somebody came by and picked me up on a Sunday school bus for 400 times before I was saved, from age 9 to age 17. What goes around comes around, whatever that means. It happened right there, whatever it means. How about the relativist? What do we say to relativism? How do we do apologetics in a relativistic world when there is no truth? There are no absolute values. My favorite story here is a student I had, a former student from Trinity, went on to get his PhD in philosophy. He was teaching in Indiana. And while he was teaching there, he had a brilliant atheist in one of his classes. And he said to the ethics class, look, write on anything you want, as long as it's in the realm of ethics. Pick your topic. Just make sure it's well footnoted, well documented, well reasoned, clearly presented. And the atheist presented this paper in that form, in that manner. The professor read it very carefully, and he wrote on it, F, I don't like blue folders. And he gave it back to the student. F, I don't like blue folders. He stormed into the professor's office. He said, that is not fair. That is not just. That's not right. The professor said, wait a minute. What do you mean fair, just, right? Those are moral principles. I thought you said everything is relative. Isn't this the paper where you said there are no absolutes? It's all like I like chocolate, you like vanilla? Yeah, that's what I said in the paper. Well, I don't like blue. F. Suddenly, the young man realized that he did believe in moral absolutes. He believed it was absolutely wrong to grade a paper F because of the color of its folder. Absolutely wrong. You know, one of the strange things happening today is atheists are being converted to theism and some later to Christianity, built on the problem of evil. Problem of evil used to be, if there's evil, how can there be a good God? C.S. Lewis said, I once thought that way. Look at the injustice in the world until I realized, hey, if there's injustice, there must be justice. If there's something absolutely unjust, there must be something absolutely just. Indeed, you can't argue against God from the problem of evil without presupposing there's a God. Same thing happened to Budzichevsky, the professor at University of Texas in Austin. Was an atheist philosophy professor, came to God and ultimately to Christ because of that. You see, the deconstructed horse isn't making horse sense. He's not engaged in stable thinking. Because on the one hand, the deconstructed postmodern horse says everything is relative, but he believes in absolutes. He's absolutely sure that there are absolutes, in fact. How about conventionalism and all meaning is relative? Never occurs to them to ask themselves this question. If all meaning is relative, how about the meaning of that statement that all meaning is relative? Just doesn't occur to them to ask basic questions like that. Because if all meaning is relative, then so is the meaning of that statement. And a relative statement can't relativize absolute meaning. So they are presupposing an absolute meaning to say all meaning is relative. Or if you want to really make your postmodern professor mad, tell him that you have read his book very carefully and you have come to exactly the opposite conclusion of what he said in the book, that he really meant to teach that there were absolutes. Because the reader can mean what he wants to mean, the book, right? And your professor will protest, as on the way down here I was reading some of Foucault, a great postmodernist, and he was protesting that people misunderstood his meaning. Why did he protest that people misunderstood his meaning when the author's meaning isn't the meaning? It's the reader's meaning that's the meaning. Or, finally, what about pluralism that says all views are true? Now, if all views are true, one of the most fundamental laws of thought is invalid, the law of non-contradiction. Because the law of non-contradiction says if T is true, all non-T is false. They can't both be true. Avicenna, the famous medieval philosopher, had people who used to deny that law in his day. And he said, look, if anybody denies the law of non-contradiction, that the opposite of true is false, if anyone denies that, just beat him and burn him until he admits that to be beaten is not the same as not to be beaten, and to be burned is not the same as not to be burned. I was debating a professor, Michael Kalenda, Constantine Michael Kalenda, University of at Rice University a number of years ago, and we were debating humanism versus Christianity, and he had read my book, which was unusual, and he said, you know, he held up the book to the students there, and he said, these Christians are narrow-minded people. You know what Geisler says in this book? Christianity is true, and everything opposed to it is false. These are really narrow-minded people. So it was my turn. I got up, and I had his book. It was called Religion Without God. That's like romance without a spouse. And I held his book up, and I said, you know, these humanists are narrow-minded people. You know what Kalenda says in this book? Humanism is true, and everything opposed to it is false. These humanists are narrow-minded. See, if C is true, all non-C is? Good. If H is true, all non-H is? False. If Christianity is true, everything opposed to Christianity is? False. In fact, the so-called pluralist is an exclusivist. You know why? Because he believes that pluralism is true and everything opposed to it is false. And he wouldn't let you say, hey, non-pluralism, namely exclusivism, is just as true as pluralism. No, they're absolutely sure of their relativism. They're exclusively determined to their pluralism. Christianity in a postmodern world, how do we reach them? We show them not simply that their view is unlivable, their view is unutterable, their view is unthinkable, their view is self-defeating. We take their basic premise and turn it back on them. I think this is certainly implied, if not an application of 2 Corinthians 10:5. We destroy arguments and every proud obstacle against the knowledge of God and bring every thought captive to Christ. You say, well, is that going to automatically win people to Christ? No, but it will eliminate some pre-evangelistic hurdles that will make it a whole lot easier for us to get the gospel to them, because if they don't believe that there's a God, you're telling them that there's a Son of God is no more than, as John Carnell used to say to his students, you're doing no more than ventilating your tonsils. You're certainly not communicating to them. Because if there is no God, there can't be a Son of God. And if there is no God, there can't be a Word of God. And if there's no absolute truth, this can't be absolutely true. We must pre-evangelize in this world. One of the saddest things I ever heard a seminary president say, and I won't mention the name of the seminary, but He got rid of the philosophy department in his seminary a number of years ago with these tragic words. There was a day when we needed apologetics, but today what we need is expository preachers. Hey, there was a day when what we needed was expository preachers only. Today, we need apologists. We need pre-evangelists. We need people who can destroy arguments, who can go to our culture that is filtering the message through and making Christianity into another form of relative. Oh, Jesus, you like the Jesus thing, eh? Jesus becomes your guru. That's fine. My guru is somebody else. That's not Christianity. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. If we're going to get that message across today, we must deconstruct deconstructionism and reconstruct the truth in which the Christian gospel makes sense. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the truth that you've given to us and the times that you have enabled us to live in, the message that we have and the milieu that's available to us. Help us to be anchored to the rock and geared to our times. Help us to be able to present your absolute truth in these relative times, and give us the grace and strength to do it as we reach out in Christ's name. Amen.